Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is going to be episode 283 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And again, this is a combo podcast as I've been doing in recent times. That's what I did in episode 282. I'm going to be talking about a lot of risk factors and prognostic factors. But this is also going to be a rapid review series. So this is going to be series 47 for Step 2 CK. And again, I also want to send a reminder, again, if you're studying for the USMLE Step 1 exam, I have a super comprehensive course. It's 30 hours long. It's taking place between the 27th to the 30th of this month. Still have some spots available. So if you want to sign up, just shoot me an email through the website and I will give you some more information. And then if you're studying for Step 2 CK, the previous 10-hour course, I've expanded it. It's now a 16.5-hour course because I want to, my goal is to include some expanded internal medicine content and cover many of the new changes that are currently tested on the exam, like those things with professionalism, ethics, communications. There's going to be a lot of biostats. And I'm going to expand the medicine content, the PEDS content, the OB-GYN content. So again, if that's something you're interested in, I have the course from the 4th to the 6th of February. And then I have the MBME Test Taking Strategies course on the 3rd. So again, if you're interested, again, just shoot me an email. I've gotten quite a pretty decent number of signups. So there's still some spots available. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. Okay, so let's go right into it, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, has been a long-term smoker. And then this person has been a long-term smoker. And then this person, over the last 3 weeks, you know, they've lost like 10 pounds. They notice like some blood in their urine, right? And their creatinine has been going up. If you see that, and let's say maybe it's like a guy that also has like this new varicocele. But I'm hoping in that circumstance you think about renal cell carcinoma, right? So renal cell carcinoma, remember, it's kind of a high yield cancer to know for exams. Obviously, the biggest risk factor for that, talked about that ad nauseum before, is smoking, right? But remember that it can cause a varicocele, right? Especially like when you have like a left-sided varicocele. Because if you remember, the renal cell carcinoma can involve the renal vein, right? And once it involves the renal vein, that will obstruct flow from the testicle on the left. Remember the gonadal veins the adrenal vein on the left, they have like weird drainage, right? So the stuff on the right, remember like the gonadal vein on the right, drains straight up into the IVC. But the gonadal veins on the left, the adrenal veins on the left, they drain into the renal vein, the left renal vein, which then crosses and then goes and drains into the IVC, right? So if you see a left-sided varicocele, a long-term smoker, you know, think about renal cell carcinoma. And then please don't forget that renal cell carcinoma, that's really kind of high yield to know. The paraneoplastics, right? You know, so associated with erythropoietin, right? So it produces EPO, so that can cause a polycythemia in the patient. And then another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with renal cell carcinoma is the fact that classically, right, if you were to, many people think that once you take step 2 CK, they don't bother about histologic descriptions anymore. I wish you all the best, right? People that have renal cell carcinoma, you'll typically find clear cells on histology, right? When you're looking at the malignancy, right? So what are some prognosis things your friends at the MBME love to test with this stuff? Well, the big thing you want to know is that these things, they love to, like they can say, oh, they'll give you a question about a person that has renal cell carcinoma. And then they ask, oh, what's the most likely location of metastasis, right? If you see a question like that, you want to think about mets to the lungs. Renal cell carcinoma loves to metastasize to the lungs, right? And you can even extend that knowledge to like Wilms tumor, right? Wilms tumor, also, if it metastasizes, it's going to be to the lungs. Remember, hopefully you can differentiate between Wilms tumor from a neuroblastoma. Remember, Wilms tumor is going to be a flank mass. It's going to be non-calcified, right? And it does not cross the midline. It's very high yield to know, right? In comparison with neuroblastomas, right, that are going to cross the midline, right? And then they love to cross the midline. That's one important thing. And then I think another important thing I should mention is that they are also calcified as well, right? And, you know, neuroblastomas love to metastasize to bone, right? So that's a high yield thing to know. And one other thing I would say that's also important is that they can ask you like, oh, which of the following is the most important predictor of prognosis? for renal cell carcinoma, that's actually going to be extension into the renal vein. Once it goes into the renal vein, right, it's basically taking a route towards the systemic circulation, right? So obviously that's like metastasis central at that point, right? But in general, for malignancies, what is the most important predictor of prognosis in a person that has a malignancy? So it's going to be if the person, it will be one of two answers on an exam, right? So it will either be that the malignancy has metastasized. Obviously, if something has mets already, it's bad, right? But then another key predictor of prognosis is also like lymph node involvement, right? So if it involves lymph nodes. So the thing I will encourage you is, because sometimes your friends at the MMA, they are really smart, and they'll put two of these things, right? So like they'll put like presence of metastasis, lymph node involvement. If they put both, pick the presence of metastasis. Because the fact that something has got into a lymph node, yes, it's metastasized, but that does not necessarily mean that it is already systemic, right? So I think that's a very high yield thing to keep in mind for exams. And then next, one other one we're just going to talk about straight up is they love to ask about obstructive sleep apnea on NBM exams and ask for the risk factors, right? So the thing is, it's actually high yield to know the risk factors by age, right? So if you're dealing with obstructive sleep apnea in a kid and they ask you for the biggest risk factor, I really hope that you're picking the answer that talks about the person having adenotonsillar hypertrophy, right? So they have like just big tonsils, big adenoids, right? So that obstructs airflow, right? And then another thing that can cause obstructive sleep apnea, the biggest risk factor in adults is going to be obesity, right? So obesity is the most important risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea in an adult, right? But again, as you know, they love to put all these questions where they talk about patient-specific risk factors, right? So if, for example, they give you a question about a person that, you know, has a BMI of like 26, and then they tell you that the person has a history of like asthma-based symptoms that are worsened by the administration of an NSAID, you know, like aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, then in those circumstances, you want to pick nasal polyposis as the biggest risk factor, as the most important risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea in that patient, right? Because remember, people that have aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, right, they love to form nasal polyps, and those nasal polyps can obstruct the airway, right, especially the nostrils, and that can increase the person's risk of having obstructive sleep apnea. Okay, so again, you just need to be wise and prudent as you're taking these NBM exams. I think it's kind of like the big thing I want to mention here, right? And then some of you may wonder, oh, Divine, what's the pathophysiology behind aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease? Well, it's pretty straightforward, right? So we know the pharmacology behind arachidonic acid, right? So we know that arachidonic acid loves to do this thing where it can either go down the cyclooxygenase pathway where you make prostaglandins, right? Or the lipooxygenase pathway where you make leukotrienes, right? So the thing is, if you give aspirin, aspirin is an irreversible inhibitor of COX-1 and COX-2. Right, so if you inhibit COX-1, you inhibit COX-2, you're going to have more flux through the lipoxygenase pathway, right? And the lipoxygenase pathway leads to the formation of leukotrienes. And leukotrienes, they can cause bronchoconstriction, they can cause many of those asthma-based symptoms, right? So that's why it's very important as a person that's trying to treat aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, they can ask you for the drug of choice in treatment. The answer that you actually want to go after on exams is going to be like a leukotriene inhibitor, right? Remember, you can inhibit leukotrienes in one of two ways. You can give a leukotriene receptor antagonist, something like montelukast or zafirlukast, right? Remember, those are the leukotriene receptor. Sometimes the NBM may get cute. Instead of calling it the leukotriene receptor, they may call it the CYSLT1 receptor, right? But alternatively, you can also give something that inhibits lipoxygenase, right? So it's almost like the aspirin of the lipoxygenase pathway. In this case, that's going to be Zileuton, Z-I-L-E-U-T-O-N, right? Although you kind of want to be careful there because that drug can cause a, you know, liver toxicity, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient has, it's a newborn. Newborn has like a white reflex instead of a red reflex, right? And then they're asking for the most likely malignancy this person may develop in the future. Well, I would hope with that, you're thinking about that kid, you know, as a newborn having a retinoblastoma, right? Having a retinoblastoma. Now, the thing with a retinoblastoma, though, is that it can, it's like RB gene mutation. Those people tend to have osteosarcomas in the future, right? They tend to have osteosarcomas in the future. And sometimes they may even ask you, what is the most likely location of an osteosarcoma on an NBM exam, right? It's going to be the knee. Most times, almost like 90% of NBME questions that involve osteosarcomas is going to be a knee problem. And then one thing I kind of want to speak to right now is something that the NBME has been doing in recent times that, I don't know, I've just seen too many people get questions wrong as a result of some of these things, right? I call these things alternate MBME vocabulary, right? So what do I mean by that? Basically, what the MBME does is they will take something that you know and just give it a different name. I mean, that's like a classic thing, right? That they love to do with the more recent, the newer MBME exams, right? So let me just go through some classic things where it has one name that most of us know. But sadly, your friends at the MBME have elected to give it another name that many people may not be very familiar with, right? So, for example, what are some key ones, right? Like, so like osteosarcoma, instead of calling osteosarcoma on an exam, they may call it osteogenic sarcoma, right? So that's something you want to be aware of. Another classic one they love to do is neurotube defects, right? You want to know that another name for neurotube defects on MBME exams is spinal dysraphism, right? They may call it a spinal dysraphism on a test. This other one, you've heard me say it, you know, ad nauseum, so you want to keep it in mind, right? Like sarcoma bodies and laminated calcifications. That's a classic one. Another classic thing they love to do, nephrotic syndrome, right? So remember, nephrotic syndrome, whenever a person has nephrotic syndrome, you're going to find fatty casts in your urine, right? You're going to find lipid casts. So essentially, on MBME exams, they may call nephrotic syndrome lipoid nephrosis. Okay, lipoid nephrosis, L-I-P-O-I-D. That's something you want to be aware of. Another classic thing they love to do is they can give you a question about a person with IgA nephropathy. Remember, IgA nephropathy, typically people have their symptoms like 2 to 6 days after the onset of an upper respiratory infection, right? So sometimes on MBME exams, instead of calling it IgA nephropathy, they may call it a sympharyngitic nephropathy. Okay, they may call it a sympharyngitic nephropathy. And then another classic one they love to do is Kawasaki's disease, right? So remember Kawasaki's disease, high fevers for a couple of days, you know, lateral anterior cervical lymphadenopathy, right? Strawberry tongue. They may have a rash on the palms and soles. And again, remember, the MBME is smart. They will very likely not put a rash on the palms and soles. They can see that the person has edema of the palms and soles, or they can tell you that the person has desquamation of the skin over the palms and soles, right? If you see that, you want to think about Kawasaki's, right? Another name for Kawasaki's disease on an MBME exam is something called mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, okay? And you may be like, come on, Devon, you've got to be kidding me. Trust me, I'm not kidding, right? Mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, right? Mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome. Okay, so let's continue. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient was started on trimethoprim sulfur methoxazole, right? For PCP prophylaxis, you know, in HIV. And then they notice that the person, a few days later, the person develops like perioral cyanosis, right? But they show you that, you know, this person's O2 sat is completely fine and this person's PaO2 is completely fine. If you see that, I'd really hope that in those circumstances, you're thinking about methemoglobinemia, right? So remember, whenever you take like a drug that's a very powerful oxidizing agent, that can cause methemoglobinemia, right? So for example, what are those drugs, right? It can be a drug that like TMPSMX, right? It can be a drug like a nitrate, right? It can be a drug like Dapsone. Remember, we use Dapsone as PCP prophylaxis in people that, you know, for some reason, they cannot take TMPSMX. And we also use Dapsone to treat leprosy, right? Remember, we can use a combination of Dapsone, rifampin, and clofazimine, right? That's another use for Dapsone. And another one that just came to mind is Dapsone can also be used to treat... Dapsone can actually be used to treat... Yes, dermatitis herpetiformis, right? That's associated with celiac disease, right? Associated with celiac disease. Sorry, I had to think about that for a second, right? So those are all uses for Dapsone, right? So those are all questions they can frame in the context of a person getting methemoglobinemia, right? So what's the pathophys behind methemoglobinemia? It's actually pretty easy, right? So all the iron that you have in your hemoglobin is in the ferrous form. It's in the Fe2 plus form, right? But if you take a powerful oxidizing agent, right? If you remember from college, oxidation is an increase. Basically, when your oxidation number, when your charge becomes more positive, it means you're becoming oxidized, right? So if you take a powerful oxidizing agent, essentially the person can go from Fe2 plus to Fe3 plus. Fe3 plus is ferric. Ferric iron cannot carry oxygen, right? So the person becomes cyanotic, right? And obviously in those circumstances, how do we treat the person? Well, actually, some things we can do, we can give the person Come on, Divine, what are you thinking about? You can give the person methylene blue, right? You can give methylene blue. That's the drug of choice. You can give vitamin C. And then another thing that you may see on exams that you may probably never have heard of in any resources is cimetidine. Cimetidine is it's an acid-reducing medication. It's a H2 blocker that we use to, you know, bring down people's acid production. Essentially, right, you're blocking the action of histamine from those enterochromaffin-like cells that we find in the stomach. Right, so cimetidine is actually pretty good at slowly lowering a person's methemoglobin levels, right? So it's just one of those weird things you may see on a test that you may be like, what, never heard of this before, right? Well, now you've heard of it, right? And the thing is, if the NBME is really smart, if they wrote this question about a person like with TMPSMX and they put like, oh, the person started for PCP prophylaxis, because obviously, right, remember, you know, you do that if the person's CD4 is less than 200, and you know, they put methemoglobinemia as an answer, you can almost bet that your friends at the NBME, one of the answers they will throw down for you is G6PD deficiency, right? G6PD deficiency. So you may say, oh, Divine, wow, that's true. How would I have differentiated between G6PD deficiency and methemoglobinemia? Well, let me give you a few tips here, right? My tips here, first things first, if the question is about a girl, it cannot be G6PD deficiency, right? Because I would hope that at this point you know that G6PD deficiency is X-linked recessive inheritance, right? X-linked recessive inheritance, so it's going to be in a boy on your test. That's one good thing that will help. And usually people that have G6PD deficiency on NBME exams, they're not going to have like physical signs of cyanosis. Their hemoglobin will be low, but they won't have like perioral cyanosis or any of those weird things, right? And then G6PD deficiency, right, usually there will be some kind of trigger, right? And the trigger can be drugs, but the thing is, other things that can trigger G6PD deficiency can be an infection, right? Can be like a really bad infection, because when you have bad infections, right, you're going to really need your oxidative burst pathway, right? But to almost like recycle your oxidative burst pathway, you kind of need, or, you know, to deal with all those free radicals and stuff, an oxygen reactive oxygen species, that glutathione pathway needs to work well, right? And you need NADPH from the pentose phosphate pathway, right? Remember, G6PD, glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase, is the rate limiting enzyme of the oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway, right? So they will give you that, right? And they may even give you a blood smear. You may find like those Heinz bodies or those bite cells, right? Or if they give you like a geographical association, like the person is from like Southeast Asia or like some African country, it's probably likely going to be G6PD deficiency as against methemoglobinemia, right? So just things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So I think since we're right at minute 17, I'm just going to go ahead and pause here. But maybe let me say one thing, right? So what is the biggest risk factor for methemoglobinemia? It's actually the use of a nitrate, right? So they can give you a methemoglobinemia question easily in a person that has a history of angina that is being treated with nitrates, right? Or they can give you like methemoglobinemia question in a person that's having chest pain in the setting of an MI, right? Remember, we give nitrates to people that have MIs to help their chest pain. Although obviously, right, you don't want to give it to a person with an RCA infarct, right? Because those people are preload dependent, right? So you don't want to tank their preload and then cause problems. And then again, as I said at the beginning, if you're interested in signing up for the Step 1, Step 2 CK courses, feel free to shoot me an email and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. And again, I also offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, 30-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I actually tutor for the medicine boards and the medicine in training exam. And then, you know, please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then I also have a YouTube channel that has all the videos I post and continue to post, right? It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos. So please subscribe to that. And then I also have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So please, you know, any subscription, any bit of encouragement definitely helps. And then my life lesson today is about insecurity. So I think one thing that's important amongst people is, or is like actually a fairly prevalent problem amongst many people, especially amongst many med students, is insecurity, right? They always feel that they are lower than what they are. The thing is, it's actually very important in life to have some sense of self-esteem, right? And maybe this may be a series that I may talk about like along with my life lessons, but I think maybe one thing I want to say about feeling insecure is stop comparing yourself with other people, right? When you compare yourself with other people, your mind is naturally going to focus on all the inadequacies you have and on all the amazing things about other people, right? So just think about yourself better, right? I think really this insecurity of a thing is something that you need to be very intentional about. It requires like a very fair amount, like a wee bit of emotional intelligence, right? And I think another thing too that also maybe is like a related concept, I don't even know if it's maybe even related to what I'm talking about, but it's just the importance of not trying to please everybody, right? That's one thing I used to do a lot in the past where, I used to try to, just help people out as much as I can. I'm not saying I don't like helping people. Don't get me wrong. I mean, to this day, it's one of my primary models in life is to help people, right? Because again, what's the point of you being on this earth if you're not doing any good in people's lives, right? But the thing is, you don't always have to say yes to everything, right? Sometimes in life, you should say no. Right? There are certain, it's not everything you're supposed to agree to, because when you're like a yes man or a yes woman, and people know that, oh, they can toy with your emotions, they will just pretty much just walk all over you, right? Like, there are some people where they're in a relationship with someone, and let's say, oh, they're like, oh, you know what, I'm a Christian, I'm not gonna have sex till marriage, blah, 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 blah. But then someone that they've met, that they've fallen for, that, oh, they're like, man, this person is great. I love this person so much. The person kind of pressures them, right? And they then don't set boundaries. And then they do things that they don't want to do just because they feel insecure, just because they feel that, oh, they could never get someone better than the spouse that they currently have, right? I mean, like, I've heard this story many times for many people doing things that are unseemly, doing things that they just really did not want to do in the first place, right? So I think just you don't always have to say yes to people, right? It's hard, but the thing is, and people may think you're mean initially, but over time they'll begin to respect you because you have boundaries, right? So the thing is, you have to first respect yourself so that other people can respect you, right? So don't always be a yes man, right? If something is convenient for you, if like, do things because you want to do them, not because you want to please people, right? Because again, if your life revolves around wanting to please people, you're gonna get in trouble, right? In fact, like, I mean, for me as a Christian, like, if I said, oh, I'm always gonna please people, then there will be things that I will do that are not consistent with the Bible, right? So again, people are not always going to be happy with you. There's always gonna be someone that hates you or hates something about you, right? So you're not always gonna be able to please everybody, right? So just do what is comfortable for you, do what agrees with your values, do what agrees with your principles, and then deal with the consequences, right? And usually you'll be blessed for it in the end, right? You usually come out on top in the end when you do that. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you and God bless you. See you next time.